This is The Takeaway. I'm WNYC reporter Matt Katz, and I'm in this week for Tanzina Vega. Since taking office, the Biden administration has pledged to overhaul many of the hardline immigration policies that former President Trump was known for. And they've also outlined an approach to immigration that they say is more humane. Here's Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas speaking on NBC this past weekend.
We're taking a look at the immigration system writ large and seeing what reforms we can achieve to ensure that the manner in which we address the needs of individuals looking for a better life adheres to the principles and values of our country and its proudest traditions.
Soon after taking office, the Biden administration issued a memo intended to halt most deportations during his first 100 days in office. That order was temporarily blocked last month by a federal judge in Texas. In the meantime, the administration has announced a less restrictive approach to deportation. People considered national security threats and those with aggravated felony convictions are prioritized for removal, and so are recent border crossers. Other immigrants without documents are supposed to be allowed to stay in the U.S. and fight their deportation cases. And yet, there's a Trump-era immigration enforcement tactic that the Biden administration is still using to deport immigrants. Starting in March of 2020, the Trump administration began using a CDC regulation known as Title 42 to justify the expulsion of hundreds of thousands of migrants at the southern border on the grounds that they represented a public health threat during the pandemic. And the Biden administration has continued to use Title 42 to expel hundreds of undocumented immigrants over the past few months. Determining how much has really changed in our immigration system under President Biden is where we start today. Here with me now is Maria Sacchetti, national immigration reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Maria. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Maria, I keep seeing this word used to refer to the Biden administration's removal of migrants and asylum seekers, and the word is expulsion, not deportation. Can you explain the difference?
Yes. Expulsion is something that happens much more quickly. Deportation is often the result of a process. Sometimes it's a very quick process, but sometimes it's a process that can drag on for decades. And you go before a judge, an immigration judge, you can appeal to the Board of Immigration Appeals, you can even appeal some things to the real federal court system, but it's something that can take a lot longer. Expulsion can happen in a matter of hours or days. There are some humanitarian protections, but far fewer.
And that's what's happening under Title 42, right? It's this expulsion started by the Trump administration, now continued by the Biden administration?
Exactly. And it's Title 42 of the Public Health Code. And the idea was to basically effectively stop crossings at the border to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Now, of course, the United States is one of the hardest hit by the coronavirus. So migrants are, just crossing into this country would be at risk themselves. That is something that the Trump administration instituted and something that the Biden administration has continued, except for unaccompanied minors. And now you see the number of unaccompanied minors rising.
Yeah. Why is the number of unaccompanied minors rising? And you said except for that group of people, how is the Biden administration handling those migrants?
Well, so a federal judge stopped the Trump administration from expelling unaccompanied migrants. These are teenagers, children who travel or are dropped off at the border by themselves without their parents, and they would be expelled to their home country. This is something a lot of people don't realize this, but this is something that routinely happens with Mexico because the two countries have an agreement. But we don't have similar agreements with third countries like Honduras or other, Venezuela or other countries. So to have expelled minors, traveling without their parents, that was a very big deal to immigrant advocates, and they sued and won in lower court, but then an appeals court overturned them. So the Biden administration has the authority to expel minors. They just have decided not to. And as a result, you're seeing more and more minors crossing into the United States. Some people say, that by expelling so many people into Mexico and also, to their home countries, the Trump administration kind of created this pent-up demand that that people are continuing to try. You're seeing a lot of repeat attempts at the border. So the numbers, each one is an encounter. Each one is someone, a Border Patrol agent has to book in and greet and process. But there are risks there on the border, you know, of spreading the disease, just like there would be anywhere in the United States. But the Biden administration has continued to expel migrant families and other people.
We mentioned that last month, a federal judge blocked the Biden administration's memo halting most deportations. How much did that ruling change the administration's approach to deportations?
So that is our understanding. You know, one thing that is always important to point out is that unlike the regular court system, you know, the kind of you see on TV, Law and Order and things mm-hmm, like that,
right.
Or just in regular news coverage, those records are public. The arrest records are public. You know who gets arrested. You none of that happens in the immigration system. You know, the arrests mm-hmm. are not public record. You can't pull a court record. So a lot of it is very foggy. So our understanding is that thousands of people have been deported this fiscal year. We don't know precisely how many Biden has deported. Many more people have been expelled under the Title 42 order that Biden has kept in place. So that continues to happen. But what the judge enjoined part of a memo that the former acting Homeland Security Secretary created on Biden's first day. And he enjoined the part that said we're going to halt deportation for 100 days. But he did not enjoin the part that set new priorities for deportation. So there are lots of people out there who normally would have been targeted under the Trump administration who are just no longer targeted.
Right.
So deportations will drop.
Yeah, like national security threats, those convicted of serious crimes are not supposed to be prioritized. I report on immigration here at WNYC, and last week I learned about a Guatemalan man living in New Jersey for the last 13 years, U.S. citizen, wife and kids, no criminal convictions, and yet a few days ago he was deported back to Guatemala. And it made me wonder that if Biden does want to be more permissive when it comes to immigration enforcement, maybe he does want that man to be allowed to stay in the country and until his case is fully processed. Do we know if ICE will do as he says? Are we getting a test now to see if ICE is a rogue agency, as some Democrats have alleged over the last several years?
Well, I think it goes beyond that. I think that, you know, I mean, how do we know it's a rogue agency? You know, how do we, why didn't we know ahead of time that the man from Guatemala who had no criminal record was about to be deported? Like what,
right.
You know, this is something that these are secret records. And so that's why so much controversy swirls around ICE and there's such a polarized view of it because no one can really get close enough to see it like the way we can in the criminal justice system and the civil system. You can go pull the records and find out if what the government is saying is true. We can find out if someone's in the system who shouldn't be there. I mean, we, through FOIAs, we found immigrant detainees who had been, when I used to work for the Boston Globe, who had been detained for 20 years and nobody knew about it. And then a man who had been detained for 14 years and he was in a wheelchair. We've been writing about this for years. And that seems to be, you know, one of the central issues here, which is just that, how are you going to know? You know, this is the thing. If the immigrant doesn't have a lawyer, doesn't have someone who will call the media and say, hey, I've been arrested.
Right.
You know, part of our job as the media is to go and find out who got arrested, but ICE simply won't tell us.
Right. I mean, that's the only way I knew. A lawyer called me. It's not like covering a local police department where you could say, hey, who did you arrest today if you're a local reporter? You can't ask ICE such a thing, right, as a reporter. I mean, they don't have to tell you.
I mean, we ask all the time, but they don't tell us. And they say it's to protect the immigrant's privacy. But if you're jailing someone and trying to deport them to some of the most dangerous countries on earth, you know, is that an appropriate response? You know, we're the media. We have to do our jobs. We're supposed to find out who got arrested. It's one of the most profound things a government can do to another person. And there may be privacy concerns, if the same that you would have for, you know, victims of sexual assaults and people who are in danger. But the criminal justice system deals with that as well.
You know, there's an immigration reform plan that Biden has announced and it's trying to move its way through Congress that would change the system that we've been talking about in many, many ways. Does it seem like that proposal has gained any traction among lawmakers so far from your perspective?
Yeah, I'm not sure it would make the system any more transparent, but which is a big issue. But I think what it would do is dramatically change the landscape for undocumented immigrants, and it would legalize most of them. So right now you have ICE, you know, deporting a small fraction of undocumented immigrants in the country, and a lot come back in. So there are questions about, you know, is this an effective way to spend several billion dollars every year? Is it making an impact? Is it making people safer? And there's a debate over that. And I think that's what's coming. And but right now, I mean, the Citizenship Act doesn't appear to have it's not something people are talking about every day. We're not hearing it at the White House briefing every day. With a lot of energy. And so maybe that will change, but there's other ways that immigrant advocates are trying to pass a bill. And so we'll definitely cover that this year.
We're trying to take pieces of it maybe, and maybe some of the pro-immigration advocates can get pieces of this accomplished, if not the whole comprehensive deal.
Well, advocates know that this year is perhaps their only chance to pass something on immigration, and they are determined to pass it. It's been 35 years since major legalization, so we'll see what happens.
We will be watching. Maria Sacchetti is a national immigration reporter for The Washington Post. Maria, thankful for your reporting. Thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
Same to you. Thank you.
One country that's been particularly affected by this is Haiti. More than 900 Haitians were deported in the first part of February alone, and at least 72 have been deported already this week. But the deportees, many of them children, are being sent back to a country in turmoil. Massive protests against President Jovenel Moïse have been met with police violence that have left dozens dead. So what could this mean politically for the Biden administration and Haitian people living in the U.S., and for Biden supporters who expected an end to such widespread deportations? Here with us to answer these questions and more is Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Hi, Jacqueline. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking about deportations. How does Haiti fit into this bigger picture? Is there a sense that people coming from Haiti are being targeted for deportation more than other migrants?
Well, you know, we really have been trying to understand this, because during the campaign, you know, President Biden, then Vice President Biden and Democratic nominee visited South Florida, specifically Little Haiti. I was at the event, and this was one of the promises that he made, that, you know, there was going to be this moratorium on deportations. So the community was very happy about this, because this has been a huge issue for them, whether they have families in this situation or not. But given the reality of Haiti currently, people felt that this was a humane thing to do. But what we saw was that after he, you know, was inaugurated, he issued his moratorium, then you had the ruling by the Texas court. But what advocates are telling me is that even with that moratorium and without the ruling of the Texas court, we would have still seen these deportations that we're seeing as it relates to Haitians because of this Title 42 rule. Now, what has been unclear to me is that whether or not everyone on those flights, whether or not they meet the standard, because I wrote a story just a few weeks ago about Paul Pirelis, who is a stateless man born of Haitian parents, but not born in Haiti, has no documentation, is not even recognized by the Haitian government. President Trump tried to send him on his last deportation flight to Haiti. That was halted. And then we see under Biden administration, this gentleman is sent back to Haiti along with others. He was not at the border. He doesn't qualify as Title 42, but he was returned back. So how many Paul Pirelis have been sent to Haiti since President Biden has come into office?
Was he somebody who had been in the country for a little bit of time? He was not a recent arrival?
40 years old. He moved to the United States when he was 5. Lived in New York.
Wow. That's, I mean, you were referring earlier to a court order, and that was one that had temporarily rejected Biden's effort to stop deportations for a period of time. So deportations are allowed to continue. But they don't have to continue, right? I mean, the Biden administration controls the agencies that run the border, and the administration can make final determinations about whether migrants should be detained, allowed into the country, or kicked out, right? So that's, I guess, what's particularly confusing about this case and others, right?
Well, yes and no, because one of the questions that have come up, you know, among some of the advocates and, of course, some of the people who support President Biden is whether or not there's been this question, lingering question out there, whether or not DHS has gone rogue. If you recall, it took a while for us to get a secretary for the Department of Homeland Security. And so, you know, just in my interviews with lawyers and immigration advocates, a lot of this was brought up where they said, look, you know, the prior administration left sort of a lot of landmines that have, you know, tied the hands of the Biden administration. And DHS has always had discretionary, right, in terms of who they deport, when they deport. And just because this Texas order went into effect, it did not say you should start deporting everybody. So they're really felt like there was the sense to just rush, to just get as many people as you can out. And what we saw in that is a lot of Haitian migrants. Advocates are telling me this week that, in fact, it's over 1,000 that have been deported and at least 16 flights. But, you know, again, I'm back to you had that little asterisk, Title 42, you know, and what they are characterizing it as, these are Haitians who are at the U.S. southern border who had been waiting to get into the United States, came in, and in some instances, they were sent back to Mexico, which was not supposed to happen, and in other instances, that they were put on flights. There's been a real lack of transparency, frankly, about these deportations, you know. Who are they? How did they get into DHS's grasp? We are hearing that, yes, there are a number of been children, 2 months old. You know, you have families. So there's a lot of questions that we don't have answers to. And even members of Congress who are really concerned about, you know, these deportations. I mean, really an uptick in deportations of Haitians that we have been seeing in the last several, months since this new administration came in.
But from your reporting, it's Haitians who both are alleged to fall under this Title 42, which you reference, which is a section of the public health code and is intended to protect the country from the spread of the pandemic. Right. This was something that was implemented by Trump and has been continued to be enforced by Biden. So there's both recent arrivals who are coming from the land border from Mexico, who originally come from Haiti, who are coming in and being deported under Title 42. But your reporting also indicates that there are other Haitians that are also getting mixed up in this, people who have lived in the country for many years, who are also being deported on these same flights.
Exactly. I mean, we showed this with Paul Pierlise, whose deportation had been halted because the Haitian government, according to them, did not give permission, did not give travel documents. And, you know, he had a previous case involving a brother, something similar, where he was deported back to Haiti and they had to bring him back to the United States. And the question that we have today is how many Paul Pierlise are also on these flights? How many people who have been living in the United States for a number of years who should have been protected under some sort of a moratorium or at least have the possibility to exhaust all of their immigration opportunities before they were returned to Haiti? And Paul Pierlise clearly showed that not everybody on these flights fall under this Title 42. We're going to protect ourselves from the spread of the pandemic.
Jacqueline Charles is Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, thanks so much for putting all this into context for us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
On the media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
In the lead-up to the 2020 election, we watched closely as states grappled with how to administer elections safely during a global health pandemic. And in many cases, that meant expanding access to the ballot. More people voted early and by absentee ballot, and that led to a higher voter turnout than we've had for a presidential election in 120 years. At the same time, a false narrative emerged about a rigged election, a conspiracy theory championed by former President Donald Trump. Now, a flurry of legislation in states across the country aims to restrict voter access. And that brings us to Georgia. Yesterday, lawmakers in the state debated election law for hours at a marathon session of the General Assembly known as Crossover Day.
It was the deadline for a bill to pass either the House or the Senate and then be considered by the other chamber from now on.
That's Mark Nisi, a reporter covering the Georgia government for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
If a bill is a House bill, it had to pass the House by yesterday. And if it's a Senate bill, it had to pass the Senate by yesterday. And anything that didn't pass on Monday is not quite dead because it could still be attached to another bill, but definitely much harder to make it into law.
Mark was in the Senate gallery yesterday for the hours-long debate that led to the Georgia Senate passing a bill that restricts absentee voting, and it passed by just one vote. What does this all mean for Georgia voters? I asked Mark what the vibe was like in the Georgia Senate.
It was, very divided between Republicans and Democrats. It's a very partisan issue over voting rights and how voters should be able to access the ballot. And so, we had Democrats and Republicans on very polarized sides. And that tension came through in the speeches that they delivered for over 3 hours yesterday afternoon. We saw, Democrats very passionately saying that the election wasn't stolen and that these proposals are built on what they said are lies from President Donald Trump. And then we had Republicans saying, no, this has been going on for a long time, and there are problems with our election system, and the time is right to correct what they view as issues by, for example, their biggest item, restricting no-excuse absentee balloting in Georgia.
The debate that was playing out on the floor, was it reflected outside? Were there protesters also from both sides going at it?
That's right. There were protesters inside and outside the Capitol while the debate was going on. Inside the Capitol, there was a sit-in on the Capitol stairs where some of the protesters wore chains to kind of show that their voting rights and their voices were potentially being silenced. And then outside, you had more traditional rallies with people using bullhorns and holding signs and marching, both in Liberty Plaza, which is kind of the public gathering area, and also closer to lawmakers around the entrances of the Capitols, urging them to either, from the voting rights protesters not pass the bill, and from those who are more Republican and Trump supporters asking legislators to crack down on voting access so that in their perception, there would be less chance of any potential fraud.
Mm-hmm. So, Mark, let's drill down on one of these election-related pieces of legislation. SB 241 passed on a party-line vote 29-20 with Republicans in favor. What's in this bill?
So this is a big bill. It does a lot of things to change Georgia's voting rules. The headline item is that it would eliminate no-excuse absentee voting, which is a law in Georgia since 2005 that has allowed any voter to request an absentee ballot without having to provide a reason. Under this bill, absentee voting would only be allowed for people who are at least 65 years old, have a physical disability, or are out of town on election day. And the bill does a lot of other things as well. It requires absentee voters to provide ID in the form of a driver's license or state ID number or a photocopy of other documentation. It allows the legislature to throw out emergency rules set by the state election board, for example, drop boxes, which were allowed for voters to drop off their ballots last year. It creates a hotline to the Attorney General's office for voters to report irregularities. It bans early voting buses that were used in Fulton County, which is Georgia's most populous county in Atlanta. And it has a provision, they were concerned about the vote count taking so long in Georgia. The bill also requires election officials to continue counting ballots until they're done, even if it takes days. So election officials would have to work in shifts to comply with that part of this legislation.
I mean, some of these restrictions seem aimed at trying to prevent election fraud. Are there cases of election fraud in Georgia that have been so significant that they've swayed elections? I mean, where are Republicans basing these efforts on? What are they basing these efforts on?
There's no evidence of fraud that would have been in the amount that could have swayed the presidential or U.S. Senate elections in Georgia. You know, in if you look back over the years, there has been fraud on smaller scales in smaller elections, but that didn't happen in these large presidential and Senate races in Georgia. So a lot of the fears about voting fraud in Georgia are based on conspiracy theories or mistruths or lies from people who believe that Donald Trump won in Georgia. There are also conspiracy theories about dead people voting or ballot box stuffing or fake registrations, and none or very little of that is true. If you look at the history of voter fraud cases in Georgia, they're almost always very minor.
Right, right. And then the backdrop to all of this is not just that Joe Biden won Georgia by a hair, but then Democrats narrowly won both of the states to U.S. Senate seats. This was a consequential election in Georgia this past year. And Democratic voters were far more likely to exercise the vote by mail option in those elections. So is this pushback by Republicans who control the legislature against not just Democratic voters, but also Black voters who are more likely to use some of these voting options that are available to them by law and are now potentially being taken away?
Yes, that's the argument from voting rights organizations, is that these policies are the kind of election rules that would disproportionately impact Black voters. There was a study from the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University that showed, for example, that absentee voting among Black voters in Georgia greatly increased between the 2016 and 2020 elections. And now, after that increase, we're seeing potential rollbacks in absentee voting. Another example, there's another bill that passed the state house that would limit weekend early voting days. And if you look at the data, you can see that on Sunday voting, Black voters disproportionately vote more. So if you reduce Sunday voting access, that would affect Black voters to a greater degree than voters of other races. So they're making an argument that these policies do have a racial impact. And I'm pretty certain that if these bills were to become law, we would see court cases arguing that these bills have a discriminatory effect.
Yeah, the former gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams, I saw an interview, she called these voting bills taken together as Jim Crow in a suit and tie, which of course refers to Georgia's history, right? And in the Jim Crow era and restricting, finding ways over many decades to restrict Black voters from accessing the ballot.
That's right. And that's this ongoing voting rights battle in Georgia that Stacey Abrams has been fighting for years now. You know, she has seen a path both toward electoral success for Democrats, but also for greater voting access for all voters. That's her main platform. You know, she has been trying to expand the electorate based on the belief that if more people vote, that will benefit her supporters and Democrats. And that has started to show to be true because Georgia is a changing and growing state. It is becoming more diverse and more people are moving to the metro areas, in particular Atlanta, and these voters are more likely to be Democrats. And then you see the reaction from Republicans where they try to do the opposite and put forward bills that instead of expand the electorate, constrict it.
So, Mark, it was widely noted yesterday that Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, a Republican who typically would preside over the Senate proceedings, did not do so yesterday because of his opposition to the election restrictions. So that's Duncan, the Lieutenant Governor. Where does Governor Kemp stand? He's a Republican. Is he expected to sign these restrictions into law if they pass both chambers?
It's hard to say. Governor Kemp has not weighed in on many of these proposals. The only thing he has been clear on is that he does support proposals that would require more identification to vote an absentee ballot in Georgia. But on issues like restricting no excuse absentee voting, he has not weighed in on that so far. And I don't know exactly what he's thinking, but I suspect that he doesn't want to wade into an issue that may not ever reach his desk. You know, he doesn't have to make the decision about whether to sign or veto the bill if it doesn't pass the House of Representatives after it passed the Senate on Monday. So I think his thoughts might be known at a more strategic juncture. You know, if the House, for example, doesn't move forward with the proposal to eliminate no excuse absentee voting, well, then Governor Kemp doesn't have to risk alienating his base by or angering the other side by taking a position one way or the other.
Well, it might not reach his desk. I mean, is it possible that some of these proposals do not end up passing the legislature?
I think it's likely that some of these proposals don't pass the legislature. I think the one that we know has broad-based support among the Republican majority in Georgia is the call for more ID before voting absentee. But all the other proposals, it's wildly unpredictable what will happen. For example, the no excuse absentee voting restrictions that passed the Senate yesterday. Back in January, the Speaker of Georgia's House, David Ralston, said that you'd have to make a pretty strong case to him to convince him that the election laws need to be changed pertaining to who can vote absentee in Georgia. And that was his position in January. Ultimately, it's not entirely his decision. It's the will of the committees and his party. But I think he sent a message in early January that it wasn't something that was a top priority of his, and also limits, that kind of limit on absentee voting wasn't in the House version of the election proposals that passed. So I don't know if that will, how much consideration that will get on the House side now that it will start considering this bill.
It seems that former Georgia Congressman John Lewis, a civil rights icon who fought for voting rights, could potentially still play a part in Georgia politics, because if the U.S. House of Representatives, they have this bill, H.R. 1, Voting Rights Act, that's named after John Lewis. If that were to pass and be signed by President Biden, do you have a sense of what that could mean for efforts like these to restrict voting in Georgia and anywhere around the country?
Well, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which is pending in Congress, would reinstate federal oversight in states that have a history of discriminatory voting practices, such as Georgia. You know, previously, up until 2013, the federal government did review voting changes before they could become law to make sure that they didn't have a discriminatory impact. And that was under the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was a landmark law passed at the height of the civil rights movement. But in 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that that federal oversight requirements were no longer valid. And so what this bill in Congress would do would create a new standard for which states were covered by the federal government for review of voting changes and voting laws before they could go into effect. You know, that bill hasn't passed right now. Right. It's just up to the state of Georgia and up to the courts based on other parts of the Voting Rights Act and other laws such as the Help America Vote Act and the National Voter Registration Act. You know, there are a lot of voting laws in this country, but there's no pre-review by the Department of Justice like there used to be.
Mark Nisi is a reporter covering the Georgia government for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Mark, thanks so much for your reporting on all of this.
Thanks for having me on.
The 1970s were a turbulent time in the United States. The anti-war movement was in full swing, second wave feminism had taken hold, and the Black Power movement had gained recognition. It was around this time that members of the gay and lesbian community, who faced discrimination in everything from housing to employment, became more visible as they advocated for equal rights under the law. Recent reporting from The New Yorker found that it was during this cultural revolution that social workers quietly began placing LGBTQ teenagers with queer foster parents, after placements in more traditional homes fell through. Karen Hagberg is 77 years old, and she was an activist in the gay movement in upstate New York in the late 60s and early 70s.
We were approached by the Social Services Department of Monroe County, New York, requesting that we find foster parents for a young teenager who was described to us at that time as a cross-dressing boy. And we would call her now a transgender woman.
Karen could hardly believe that during a time when homosexuality was criminalized, that the state was reaching out to the gay and lesbian community in an official capacity.
This seemed so radical and so subversive and so amazing on the part of the Department of Social Services that we felt compelled to answer their request in the affirmative.
Karen and her partner applied and became foster parents to a transgender African-American teenager named Vera, who had previously been moved in and out of several failed foster placements.
She was able to be herself in our home, and she hadn't been with gay people before. And here we were lesbians, and we had lots of gay male friends and other lesbians coming and going, and it was very different from other foster families she had been exposed to. She had discovered a community of trans women, and she hung out with them and felt good when she was around them.
To learn more about the history of the seemingly radical act of placing queer youth with gay and lesbian foster families in the 70s, I spoke to Marie Amelie George, an assistant professor of law at Wake Forest University specializing in LGBTQ rights, and Michael Waters, a freelance writer who wrote about this recently for The New Yorker.
The main thrust of this piece is talking about these series of foster care placements that happened loosely and without a connection in the early 1970s. And essentially what happened is individual social workers and social work agencies started reaching out to the queer community in different ways, essentially in order to register queer people as foster parents. One of the first times that you see like this sort of mainstream recognition of queer people as potentially parents. And this took all sorts of forms. A lot of times what happened is social workers had these queer kids who were in and out of the foster care system. So they'd go through multiple homes, and a lot of times they would be failed placements, and a lot of these families rejected them because the kids were queer and especially trans or gender nonconforming. And so some individual social workers, just kind of out of desperation, seemingly would place like ads in gay newspapers, for instance, basically saying like, hey, we have this kid, will you take care of them for us? And so, I mean, for this piece, I spoke to a couple people who, you know, responded to those ads or responded to requests from social workers and actually got registered as parents, like officially with the county or state for the first time.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about some of those specific examples. It's an extraordinary reporting. Marie Amelie George, this is a pretty remarkable set of circumstances given the time period, right? I mean, advocating for gay and lesbian rights was certainly part of the cultural shift taking place during the 70s. But can you give us some context for what was going on in society at the time?
So let me give you sort of two separate strands of background that are really useful for understanding what's happening now or during this period. Mm-hmm. The first is just an incredible cultural revolution that is happening in the late 60s and early 70s. There's a rise of New Left with student protests against Vietnam. There's a growing militancy in the civil rights movement, also in large part coming from students. There's a rise of second wave feminism. So there's just a spirit of radicalism and advocacy for social change that is really palpable around this time. And it gives rise to a new wave of gay and lesbian rights advocacy. Before the Stonewall riots in 1969, most gay and lesbian rights advocates were emphasizing, you know, middle class conformity and having mainstream society tolerate gays and lesbians. After Stonewall, there's the rise of a new gay liberation movement, which is really talking about how being gay is just as good as being straight. And so it takes on a new tone. It becomes much more militant. And as part of that, they are pressing for advocacy in all parts of their lives. So an end to employment discrimination until the early 70s. Being gay or lesbian was an automatic basis for being fired from jobs with the federal government. You couldn't get a security clearance. Until 1961, every state criminalized consensual same-sex sexual activity, and that started to change in the early 70s. Gays and lesbians who socialized at bars could be arrested just for being gay there under lewdness, vagrancy, and disorderly conduct charges. And so there's really a strong movement to expand gay rights in this period.
So, Michael, let's get into one of these examples. Don Ward is one of the children you wrote about in your story, and his biological parents signed him over to Washington State when he was 15 years old after they found out that he was gay, and that's why they did so. What was life like for Don before and then after he was placed with a gay foster parent?
The first few homes that Don was placed in were quite bad for a number of different reasons, but a lot of them did center around his sexuality. And also Don, although he identified as, he was a cis man, he did, you know, like try on makeup. He was sort of playing with gender in a way that I think especially drew notice to him in this system that was not friendly to queer people in the slightest. And so, you know, he told me that after every placement, he talked to a social worker named Marianne. And at some point, after a few of these failed foster placements, Marianne decided that they had to try something new. She sort of had the wild idea to reach out to a gay person. And Don Ward, around this time, for context, was involved in the gay scene in Seattle. So he was going to this place called the Gay Counseling Center, for instance, mostly on a social basis. And a lot of like queer adults and other queer kids around his age started to hang out there. And so he had some of these early connections to the queer community. And at the same time, there were a series of protests in Seattle around police brutality against queer people. And he actually participated in some of those as well. And so, you know, his social worker hearing that and seeing all the wrong that was happening in these like straight cisgender families that didn't accept him, she decided to reach out to an activist in the community who was a gay reverend at the time and who was also one of the protest leaders. And she basically took him to a cafeteria and said, "Hey, are you willing to be a foster parent for this child?" And he said yes.
Marie Emily, in the 70s, social workers were quietly placing queer youth with gay and lesbian foster parents at a time when homosexuality was criminalized in the U.S. How do you square the state-sanctioned placement of these children with gay and lesbian families with the fact that states themselves were simultaneously anti-LGBTQ?
It seems incredibly radical, but it's less so when you think about why it is that people were afraid of gay and lesbian parents. No one was sure how it is that people became gay, right? There was this theory that dated back decades that people learned to be gay, right? It wasn't an innate trait, but rather that people learned from role models and were indoctrinated into, you know, the so-called gay lifestyle. And so one of the big fears in the lesbian mother and gay father custody cases was that by allowing these parents to have custody of their children, the state was basically going to allow these children to grow up to be gay. What made the adoption and foster care context different is that these were self-identified gay and lesbian teens. So this harmful outcome, this fate had already befallen them. So it's not like gay and lesbian parents could make the situation bad. It was already there.
Right.
The real shift and sort of radical move was when gay and lesbian parents started fostering young children who didn't self-identify in any particular way. And at that point, a lot of social science research had come out showing that, you know, parental sexual orientation had no impact on children's future sexual orientation. So social workers were much more comfortable with that.
Michael, what was it like for the foster parents themselves, and you spoke to some of them, to hear from a social worker, to get a call, and for them to become parents sort of unexpectedly?
Yeah, I think the foster parent I spoke to who best exemplifies this is Karen Hagberg, who fostered a child in Rochester, New York around 1972. And the way she described it to me is that it was such a surprising thing to be asked that she just couldn't turn it down just because it felt so revolutionary. She almost felt compelled to do it. And so the way it happened for her, a newspaper ad from 1972, in which the county social services department had advertised in the gay newspaper for Rochester, essentially saying, we have this girl who's been in and out of the system, this trans girl. And their exact wording was something along the lines of, we feel that a gay family would be the best placement. Karen Hagberg doesn't remember exactly how she responded to that ad, but at some point she did. And she was at the time living with a girlfriend named Kate. And the two of them responded, said they were interested, and the county sent them over paperwork. And I mean, I mentioned that also because the paperwork wasn't even really ready to have queer parents as foster parents. For instance, the papers that they were assigned to fill out in order to register with the county assumed that the couple would be a man and a woman. So Karen and Kate, they literally just crossed out man and woman and instead wrote lovers. And so the system, although the county had reached out, it wasn't necessarily equipped to deal with foster parents. And I also think an important thing to note, too, is that, you know, Karen and Kate were in their early 20s at the time. And she did tell me that she almost felt compelled to say yes because it was such a radical proposition in the first place. But I mean, she herself was quick to admit that she didn't know that she was the most equipped to be a foster parent in the end. And I think that was true of the foster parents that I did speak to. It just felt like, how could you say no to this? You know, they did their best, but I don't think any of them necessarily thought that they were as ready as they could have been.
And then in terms of finding foster homes for these queer foster youth, what role did activism play at this time, Marie Amelie? I mean, in terms of like just making sure that these kids were taken care of and highlighting these issues.
Social workers were turning to gay and lesbian rights groups, and they were self-identified as gay and lesbian rights groups at the time, as opposed to LGBTQ, and were asking them to find foster parents for them. So some of these organizations, like the Mattachine Society, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, they were setting up formal programs to put social workers in touch with potential foster parents. Sort of these ads in gay and lesbian newspapers that Michael described are ones that gay and lesbian rights organizations are producing and they're circulating. There's also a sharp increase in just the number of organizations addressing gay and lesbian issues. There are specific lesbian mothers groups, gay fathers groups, and they provide networks of support for people who want to become parents.
Marie Amelie, let's talk about today. Michael reported that only 25 states prohibit agencies from discriminating against prospective parents on the basis of sexuality and gender identity, and some agencies today continue to reject gay parents for foster placements because they're gay. President Obama barred such agencies from receiving federal funds. President Trump reversed that. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court is expected to rule this year on whether the city of Philadelphia was within its rights to not renew a contract with Catholic Social Services because that agency won't allow same-sex couples to foster children. Could that Supreme Court case be a breaking point in this story that we've been talking about that's been ongoing over the last four decades?
So it's possible that the court will rule that these agencies can't discriminate based on sexual orientation. It might also be the case that the court rules they can. But there's also some possibilities in the middle. They could really narrowly tailor this and say, look, these agencies are private agencies, but they're performing a quintessential public service, right? Foster care has been a state program. They are working as agents of the state. And so because of that, we're going to treat them differently than, say, a private business. And so we're going to say you're basically acting with the state's authority, which means you have to follow the rules that the state imposes.
Marie-Emily, Michael, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for
thank
having
you
us.
So much.
Marie-Emily George is an assistant professor of law at Wake Forest University, and Michael Waters is a freelance writer who focuses on queer history. Special thanks to Michael for his excellent reporting in The New Yorker and for introducing us to Karen Hagberg, one of the queer foster parents who cared for LGBTQ youth. That's all we have for you today. Call us if you have any thoughts or show ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also shoot me a tweet. I'm at MATTKATZ00. You could also record a voice memo on your phone and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.